Welcome to Bloomberg Opinion on Bloomberg Radio, bringing you news, comments, and insights from Bloomberg Opinion's worldwide team of editors and columnists. I'm your host, June Grosso. This week, why California's stay-at-home order is a legal mess. Also on the show, how ESPN's coronavirus sports programming is a stretch. Plus, why deflecting blame won't pay off for President Trump. But first, earlier this week, President Trump signed an executive order to prevent hoarding and price increases of supplies amid the coronavirus outbreak. Americans' frantic buying sprees have created shortages in products like hand sanitizer, toilet paper, and face masks. The U.S. is one of the most prosperous countries in the world. So what's driving Americans to this hoarding behavior? Bloomberg Opinion columnist Noah Smith is here to tell us. Noah, what's the difference between hoarding and stocking up so that you'll be prepared if you're indoors for a while?
Well, there's no technical difference between those. Stocking up can be rational if society is going to turn off for a long time and stores are going to be out of things. That's not the situation we're in. The toilet paper factories are still making the toilet paper. The soap factories are still making soap. It's just that people are stocking up a ton. Some people are stocking up precautionarily just in case society does collapse, et cetera, you know, and some people are more afraid of that than others. But a lot of people are just going and buying because they know everybody else is going to go and buy and they want to get in ahead of the rush. And that actually creates more of a rush.
Well, when you see shelves where toilet paper used to be empty, shelf after shelf after shelf and store after store, a bit of a panic sets in.
Yeah, that's right. And so psychological panic can add to the rational incentive. And in fact, when people do experiments, they find that both sort of rational predictions of other people getting crazy and, you know, sort of behavioral psychology stuff making you get crazy are both important motivations for hoarding.
You discuss in your column the hoarding of soap in particular. And in 1991, while stores in Soviet Union were chronically low on soap, and a study was done of this.
Right. And we're used to the idea that shortages happen in countries that use price controls to hold prices down too low. So everybody, you know, buys up too much stuff. So that was the case in like the Soviet Union, more recently Venezuela, things like that. But, you know, this is not a situation like that. We can't just free up the price system and then the shortages are going to disappear. We have to do something more.
So what should be done?
So the first thing we need to do is get information out to people about where toilet paper and soap are still available. Now, that sounds counterintuitive because if everybody's getting broadcast a message, this store has soap, then the last two stores that have soap are going to get raided, right? But actually not, because people, because they know they have that information, will feel more secure that they'll be able to find soap when they need it. And so they won't go out and hoard as much in the first place because they'll have that information instead. And so that will, you know, reduce the incentive to hoard. And the second thing that needs to be done is that stores need to limit the amount that each customer can buy on a trip. Now, that doesn't completely count hoarding because you can have these crazy people who just go from store to store to store buying your two bars of soap at each store or whatever, right? So you can have that. So it doesn't completely prevent hoarding, but it makes it a lot harder. I mean, going from store to store to store in a pandemic, especially in a city that's shut down, is a lot harder and scarier than it sounds. So having item restrictions per customer per trip are going to do a lot of this work.
A lot of stores in New York City have started that on certain items like soap, hand sanitizer, which I can't believe some of the prices that are being put on hand sanitizer. It's crazy. So what about price controls?
So price controls don't really stop hoarding. In normal times, price controls actually cause hoarding. But in the current time when people are going to be doing some kind of hoarding anyway, what price controls do is they make it more random and therefore more equal. So in other words, if you hold down the price of sanitizer, then, you know, people are still going to try to buy all the sanitizer, but who gets it will be more determined by who randomly shows up instead of, you know, who just has the most money and can gouge everybody else. And like, you know, you have these price gougers who buy up a whole bunch of sanitizer and then like trickle it out to everybody else and like gouge the prices. So price controls will increase equity, but they won't stop hoarding, but they probably won't cause a lot of hoarding either. What we need to do is just limit number of purchases and get information to people about where to find stuff.
Are any government agencies that you know of thinking about having a website where this information is available, where you can get soap, where you can get toilet paper?
You know, I couldn't find any. And it's the problem that a lot of local and state governments, and especially the federal government, are just not used to sort of this kind of coordination of economic activity. It's more of a wartime thing. You know, it's we did this during rationing in World War II, and we haven't done it in a very long time, and we're not used to doing it. And those laws may still be in place to do that, but cities and states aren't used to doing that.
It seems like one area where they could stop this price gouging is on the internet, where you see some incredible prices for things like toilet paper, $100 for a few rolls of toilet paper or hand sanitizer.
Right. And so by limiting the number of purchases that people are allowed to make, you can sort of put a stop to that. You have to also limit it at the wholesale level, because price gougers can buy wholesale and then, you know, sort of hoard, then that's bad. So you have to also do quantity controls at the wholesaler and, you know, and distribution level.
I wonder, as this goes on, if it will get better, if the initial panic will be over and people will realize that, you know, the toilet paper is still being made. It's still going to come. The soap is still going to come.
That will happen eventually. I mean, all the people who are just sort of rationally, you know, preparing just in case already have all their toilet paper. You know, I happen to buy, I didn't even hoard. I just tend to buy 2 months of toilet paper periodically and had done that just at the correct time. but the point is that eventually everybody's just going to have these giant stocks and people aren't going to raid the shelves.
Thanks, Noah. That's Noah Smith, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. On March 19th, California Governor Gavin Newsom ordered that all of the state's 40 million residents go into home isolation in an effort to stymie the spread of the coronavirus. Newsom's stay-at-home order may be necessary as a matter of public health, but what about the legality? Bloomberg Opinion columnist Noah Feldman, a Harvard law professor, writes that the order is a legal mess, and he's here to tell us why. So, Noah, you write that there is a problem with the California governor's stay-at-home order, first of all, because there's no exception for the press.
Yeah, as written, the way that the California governor's order operated was that it said you have to stay home unless you're in one of these essential industries. And then it defined the essential industries by pointing you to a federal government website of something called the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, which most people have never heard of, which is part of the DHS.
Haven't.
Yeah. And that gave a long list at the time that the order was issued of 16 crucial infrastructure sectors, which unfortunately did not include a free press. Now, the good news is that the next day, or maybe late that night after the governor's order came out, the federal government seems to have noticed this problem also. So they issued a new guidance, which you still can't find on their website, but they did issue it. I saw a copy of it, which added the press, or at least frontline reporters, to exempt section. So that's a slight improvement, although you can see how messy it was.
But if, in fact, the press is exempt, and we can see TV reporters covering stories on the streets of California, does it matter that it is not explicitly mentioned in the governor's order?
Well, yeah. I mean, it mattered a lot for two reasons. First, it mattered at the beginning because there was actually a plausible legal argument to be made that it wasn't included. And then once it was subsequently more or less included indirectly, then it still makes a difference because it doesn't send the message to the public that the press and freedom of information is, in fact, a crucial infrastructure sector without which a free society can't operate. You know, it's just not good that we have a list of, you know, 16 areas in which we can't live without that doesn't highlight the press, because especially under circumstances of a pandemic, information is gold. I mean, that's what we need to know. And a lot of the other important infrastructure, like the infrastructure to present, to allow television cameras to operate and to allow phone and radio and television, that only makes sense if there's some good content on it. Like, someone has to produce the content, and that's the press.
Now, let's talk about the rest of the order and some of the other things. It's that it was badly drafted. You say there are contradictions with the state's website, with the governor's speech, with common sense. Tell us about some of those.
Well, I think by now we've sort of realized that the California order, like at least so far, the New York order, the Massachusetts order, and some other orders, is meant to allow people, for example, to leave their homes for exercise, as long as they stay 6 feet away from each other, to leave their homes to maybe assist elderly relatives or other people in need who need help. These sort of commonsensical things that we now are observing people doing. But none of those things was explicitly provided for in the California order. So as written, it didn't allow for any of those exemptions. It didn't say anything about going outside your house for exercise. It didn't say anything about going outside your house to take care of people in need. And in all those ways, you know, it's really bad to have an official legal order that says one thing and then a real world practice that says another, because from the minute that you announce such an order, you're basically telling people that it's okay to ignore the text of the order. And that's not good. You know, I mean, laws should be followed. And if the law is meant to be more broad and allowing people to have exemptions, it should say so. It shouldn't just be up to the discretion of the police. And it certainly shouldn't be up to ordinary people to say to themselves, well, wait a minute, can I go out or not? You know, I mean, if you want to say exercise, then the government should say exercise your judgment. It doesn't make sense for the government to say, here are the rules, but by the way, go ahead and break them according to your judgment.
So the California Attorney General's office is huge. They have lawyer upon lawyer upon lawyer. How bad is the legal drafting here on a scale of 1 to 10?
I mean, in terms of the way it came out in the first instance, I would put it pretty bad. I mean, if 10 is the worst possible draft, and one is a perfect draft, I would put this somewhere in the, you know, in the fives or sixes. It's pretty bad. I would not have given it a passing grade. Let's put it that way. If it were produced by one of my students, because, you know, the bottom line is ambiguity is a problem in a public health crisis. We need to know what to do. And admittedly, lots of people won't read the actual order. Lots of people will listen to the governor's speech or something like that. But you know, the people who do bother to look up the actual order should get guidance from it.
Is there any problem with a governor just issuing a stay-at-home order like this, if it were properly drafted?
That's a great question, June. And I think the answer is, as long as that order includes within it reasonable exemptions to keep the economy going, to cover basic civil liberties, including freedom from arbitrary arrest and freedom of the press, and if the order is not clearly enforceable by anything other than, you know, the police very nicely asking you to comply with it, then it's constitutionally fine. But there are plenty of scenarios where an order could go too far. And plenty of state governors may be tempted before this is over to adopt more draconian approaches where they say, you know, you really can't go out without exceptions. And we're going to enforce this with police ordering you to. I mean, I don't think any governor wants to do that. But if they don't get compliance, they may be tempted to do that. And once you start going down that road, you really need proper legal authority and judicial oversight. And it's not clear that a lot of these governors really have the full legal authority they would need to do that. And it's also not clear that if they did have a legal authority and they issued those orders, that they would really comply with our basic constitutional rights.
In theory, is litigation possible over the California governor's order?
100%. I mean, if, in fact, it were enforced in a way where somebody were fined or just ordered off the streets or blocked from, let's say, seeing loved ones or some other, you know, concrete necessity, that person could go to court and challenge the order. Now, right now, at this exact moment in time, my guess is that most courts would be pretty deferential to the government and to its determination of what counts as a public health necessity, because, after all, we're in the midst of a major viral outbreak. That said, you know, 3, 4, 5 weeks from now, when we have a better sense of how the pandemic is going and we have a better sense of the dangers and the risks and also of the ways in which things are less risky, I would not anticipate that courts would be quite so deferential. There's usually a kind of cycle to these things. Right now, we're in the point of the cycle where courts would probably be pretty deferential, but over time, we'll come out of that cycle.
Thanks so much, Noah. That's Noah Feldman, a Harvard Law professor and Bloomberg Opinion columnist. The Tokyo Olympics have been delayed by a year due to the global pandemic. Earlier this month, the National Basketball Association, National Hockey League, Major League Baseball, and virtually every other sports league canceled or postponed their games for the foreseeable future. Networks devoted to sports are having to get creative. Bloomberg Opinion Media columnist Tara LaChapelle is here to tell us how. So, Tara, the 51st National Stone Skipping Competition, I've never heard of the 50 before that, and the World Sports Stacking Championship, what are these?
So these are some of the seldom seen sports that ESPN has had to turn to lately in the absence of regular sports programming. So I recently learned that sports stacking is basically a competition where people race to stack cups on top of one another in different formations. And it's very intense. I watched a lot of YouTube videos of this. And then some of the other, you know, sports that wouldn't normally be on a network like ESPN or ESPN2, the company has had to sort of embrace those. And one way they've done it is ESPN2 has this sort of alter ego called ESPN 8 the Ocho. And for anyone who's seen the Ben Stiller comedy Dodgeball, that's what that comes from, that movie. And so ESPN a few years ago decided to embrace that. And one day a year, they become ESPN 8 the Ocho. And it's their little zany alter ego with all these sports that they wouldn't normally air. And so they pushed that up earlier this year and decided to do it in March because of this absence of live sports. They really have nothing else to air except for classic games, which you can only do so much of that, and commentary, which there's not a whole lot to talk about when there aren't sports games being played. So we're seeing things like cherry pit spitting competitions.
And I was going to bring that up. Cherry pit spitting. I mean, how much of this can people watch?
It's funny because I think the initial reaction to this is one of excitement. I think people, maybe people who don't normally watch sports, were like, this is really fun. And, you know, everyone's yearning for something different and something entertaining while we're all sort of sheltering at home right now. And so it is fun at first. But I think, you know, over time, people are really going to miss sports. Disney, especially the parent of ESPN, is going to miss it because, you know, it's a lot of lost advertising revenue for them. And over time, this will be painful for the companies and for sports fans. But for right now, you know, it's a little bit of fun, a little bit of variety to keep people sane while we're all just trapped indoors.
So Disney, the theme parks are closed, the cruise lines are shuttered, the film business is not operating right now. Tell us about its profit model.
Yeah, so Disney gets about $5.5 billion of its operating profit, which is a total of $11 billion in the last 12 months from their cable network. So that's really the big money maker for them. It's the Disney Channel, the channel that used to be ABC Family. It's now called Freeform, and ESPN and ESPN2. And then on the broadcast side, which is another $1.5 billion in operating profit, that's ABC and their broadcast stations. So not having, you know, viewership is going to be up across the board for TV networks, but at the same time, not having sort of that bread and butter sports content is going to be an issue. And also the fact that Disney and other studios are not going to be producing new content. You know, they've shut down production of different films and TV shows because of the pandemic. So apps like Disney Plus and other, you know, streaming services, they're going to eventually run out of new material if we don't get these studios back up and running.
Is it leading people to cut the cord, to turn towards streaming?
I think it might. I think there's two ways that you could look at this. So in the one sense, if people start to feel financial strain because of everything that's happening and people losing their jobs or losing hours at work, you know, they might look at their $100 or so cable bill and say, that's something that I can go without if I need to. And so you could see people cutting the cord and maybe turning to these streaming apps, which are technically cheaper individually. So like Disney Plus costs about $7 a month, or you can get Disney and Hulu for $13. But I think what people will start to see over time, especially those who like to binge watch and maybe are subscribing to a lot of these services, is that you kind of start to get bored with each of them the more time you spend with them, because there's only so much to watch. As much as they brag about thousands of hours of content, you know, really there's probably only a handful of shows and a few movies that you really want to see on these. So I think people could start to get bored with them and also start to look at, you know, if you need to subscribe to multiple apps, that starts to get very expensive and it starts to look like cable again, which we've discussed, you know, over and over again, that subscribing to HBO, Disney, having internet access, all these different things, it starts to become quite expensive. So I think if the economy is suffering,
people will have to make those decisions that, you know, what is worth having? What do we really need and what's worth paying for?
Thanks, Tara. That's Tara LaChapelle, a media columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Despite ignoring early warnings, President Trump has repeatedly denied responsibility for the government's failure to provide enough test kits and medical supplies for the exploding coronavirus outbreak in the U.S.
No, I don't take responsibility at all because we were given a set of circumstances and we were given rules, regulations, and specifications from a different time. Wasn't meant for this kind of an event with the kind of numbers that we're talking about.
Bloomberg Opinion columnist Jonathan Bernstein writes that if Trump wants to get reelected and if McConnell wants to remain Senate Majority Leader, they need to focus all their energies on alleviating the crisis, not attempting to shift blame for it. He's here to tell us why. So for those of us who are not following the Senate closely, tell us what Majority Leader Mitch McConnell did with that vote on Sunday.
Well, you know, they were in the process at that point of negotiating the deal, and they were still, you know, not quite there yet. And nevertheless, McConnell decided to hold on both Sunday and then again on Monday a series of test votes, basically, designed really to just get Democrats. He knew what the vote was going to be. It was going to be essentially a party line vote. And so it put Democrats on record as against the Republican bill, even though, you know, negotiations were continuing and the vote had nothing whatsoever to do with that.
So are you seeing partisan politics as usual then?
A little bit. You know, one of the things that leaders try to do, and they're entitled to do, it's a reasonable part of things, is to force votes that make the other party look bad. But, you know, nobody's going to care months from now that Democrats voted the other way on a procedural vote of something that was eventually going to pass in a series of things that are eventually going to pass. It just was pointless. And, you know, what I worry about is too much of McConnell and Trump as well worrying about short-term political fallout today, winning today's messaging war, and not thinking in terms of what they really need to do if Trump is going to find a way to get reelected, which is making substantive progress on the real problems.
So recessions are not good for the reelection prospects of incumbent presidents, to say the least. Tell us what history shows us.
Well, in a normal situation, even a mild recession in the second quarter of the election year would essentially doom a president and would certainly doom a president like Trump, who has struggled in the approval ratings to begin with. What we can say about the current recession, first of all, it's going to be way deeper than, you know, anybody has seen in an election year. So it's sort of off the scale bad for him. On the other hand, there's never been a election year recession that was caused by a discrete event that people may not blame him for. So, you know, there's at least a fighting chance that for Trump that past results do not predict current situation. It's very difficult for social scientists who are used to working with, you know, extrapolating from old data to new situations to really know how this will play out.
But will the electorate blame Trump for the way he's handling this situation? And it's obvious the way he's handling it because we're seeing him at these press conferences, these marathon press conferences every day.
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to tell. One of the things that happens normally is presidents are held responsible whether they are responsible or not for the economy. So if the economy is great, they get credit. If the economy is bad, they get blamed. And it may have nothing whatsoever to do with them because presidents do not control the business cycle. Now, this time, you know, that would imply, if that holds for this one, he's going to get clobbered by the electorate, whether he could have been dealt with it perfectly or not. But again, we just don't know how, you know, people may say, well, this was not his fault, even though normally people would blame him, even if it wasn't his fault, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And we've talked before that President Trump tends to bend the truth a lot, putting it very generously. But does that seem to show more in the light of this crisis and what, you know, medical professionals are saying right around him?
Well, one of the things that all of the, you know, communication specialists, crisis communication specialists say is that it's very, very important for the government to have credibility. It's very important for them to stick to the truth because they want, you know, it's important for ordinary citizens to believe the government when they tell them to, when they ask for sacrifice, when they ask people to do things, you know, like staying home, like, you know, whatever it is. And Trump has never worried about his reputation for honesty. He's always preferred, you know, spinning things and flat out lying to make it sound as good as possible right now, not worrying about how what will happen after that's exposed. And that's always been a problem for his presidency, and it certainly hurts him in this situation.
Jonathan, thanks so much. That's Jonathan Bernstein, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Over the span of less than a week, virtually every major institution in American life has been subject to radical changes in daily operations. Has it also reshaped politics? Here to tell us more is Tyler Cowen, a professor of economics at George Mason University and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. You write that COVID-19 and the Democratic presidential primaries could be seen as the death of the progressive left. So let's start with the Democratic primaries. Some might say progressives went further than they ever have before and ignited a base.
Well, Bernie Sanders won many more votes 4 years ago than he did this time around, and Elizabeth Warren badly underperformed expectations. Once large numbers of people were allowed to vote, Joe Biden won it very easily and without even spending much money.
So does that lead you to believe that progressives can't come back in 4 years and do better?
Well, I think it will be very hard. It's not just that fact. I think the coronavirus is changing the entire national debate. People are not so interested right now in hearing about the microaggressions suffered by others. The egalitarian instinct is waning. People are looking out more for themselves. There'll be a lot more government intervention, but I don't think it will be taking on a very progressive character. I think we'll see a surge in a kind of authoritarian centrism.
Start with stimulus and how COVID-19 will affect people's views on stimulus.
Well, right now, everyone favors stimulus, which we should do, but I doubt if we will do it well. We'll throw a lot of money at businesses. The new money to fund potential progressive programs won't really be there. Those will leave the debate. So in that regard, I think the progressives will simply become followers. They'll mostly vote yes for what is being proposed. They won't really have a distinct message.
This is looking at it in the worst possible way. Is there a way to look at it that's
Well, you say
positive?
Worst possible way, but I don't favor all of these progressive ideas. So it's not all bad. The coronavirus is completely bad, but the political effects will be very mixed, some bad, some good, right?
So what about the open international border, that idea?
Immigration already is much less popular. Virtually all nations are closing their borders. It's not clear when regular migration will resume. Probably not soon. It could take years. Immigration as an issue for progressives is very much dead already.
Are you positing into this that the coronavirus will be with us in a major way for quite some time to come, for years or for months? Or what are you positing here?
I don't know how long it will be with us. Some forecasts stretch for as long as 18 months, but it will so affect our lives for that time. The cultural impact will be enormous, just as 9/11 had a policy and cultural impact far greater than the 3,000 or so lives that were lost. This is really making a big difference to our lives every day for months.
And this will be a bigger impression than 9/11 or the financial crisis.
In my opinion, much bigger than either, yes.
Well, what about some causes that most people agree on, like climate change, environmental legislation? What about that?
Well, I'm a strong advocate of doing a lot, but I think you see with our slow response to the coronavirus, it's unlikely we're going to get our act together. So there can be doom and hundreds or thousands of deaths, you know, just a week or two away. And so many Americans are just going out partying, la-di-da, let's go to my favorite bar. I think at this point you need to be very skeptical that we'll address climate change and think more in terms of geoengineering or responding to it. I don't like that, but that's the evidence I'm seeing.
Isn't there room to do both?
We should do both. We can do both. We could do both. But if you look at what people actually are doing, they're waiting until the last minute to adjust. And with climate change, that really is not an option. With coronavirus, it's not a great option either. But at least within 18 months, there's a good chance you can fix things. With climate change, it takes, 20, 30 years. And right now, we're still not really making good progress. I wouldn't write off that we should do it, but if you're just making predictions, I would write off its chance of succeeding.
And you said there will be more of a not-in-my-backyard mentality.
Yes, people retreating to, their rural or country homes, or people in the suburbs already have it much better. The problem is worst in New York City, which has a subway and is densely populated. So the way people will process that is they're not going to be clamoring for a big mass transit bill 4 years from now, or probably not even 8 years from now. Again, that's probably the wrong reaction, but that's what I'm expecting.
Thanks, Tyler. That's Tyler Cowen, a professor of economics at George Mason University and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Opinion. You can read more at Bloomberg.com/opinion or at OPI and Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. For Bloomberg Radio, I'm June Grosso. Our producer is Samara Lenga. Thanks for listening. And remember to tune into the next edition of Bloomberg Opinion right here on Bloomberg Radio.